from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we continue our discussion about the presidential election with political science professor Dave McEwen and from Sonoma State and KQED's own Scott Schaefer. How did the pollsters get things so wrong, and where does the country go from here, and what does it all mean for California? Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. We were going to go into local and state coverage in this hour. We will hold off till tomorrow because we had the president's speech in that first hour, and there are many people who obviously want to talk about the election of Donald Trump as the 45th president. So we will continue our coverage of last night's historic victory for Donald Trump and where our divided country goes from here. And we do want to hear from you. You can call us at 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your calls, 866-733-6786. You can also post comments on our website, kqed.org, or on Facebook, or tweet us. And you can tweet us at our Twitter handle, which is at KQED Forum. In this hour, we're going to talk with David McEwen, who is professor in the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State University, and he joins us here in studio. Welcome to the program, David McEwen.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you, and good always to have Scott Schaefer with us, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, who, like the rest of us, stood up and is maybe a little bleary-eyed more than usual here this morning. Scott, thank you for all your good coverage.
You bet.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
I guess I'd like to begin particularly because we're getting a lot of emails and postings on this whole question of how do we get together? How do we get together as a country again when there's so much division? You know, people were talking about this almost like another civil war, and it brought divisions that maybe were under the rocks and certainly were not in plain sight for a long period of time. So that's the challenge now. We're hearing conciliatory notes from not only President Obama and Secretary Clinton, as expected, but also from Donald Trump. And, you know, even taking him on his word, there are many people who are obviously skeptical, cynical, and feeling betrayed.
That's a good start. Certainly the president's remarks just a few moments ago and Hillary Clinton's very conciliatory and, you know, an olive branch from Donald Trump last night, something we hadn't heard for the last year or so from him. But, you know, Donald Trump is going to be under a lot of pressure as well to deliver. And now that they have control of maintain control of the House and the Senate, they can run the table. And now Trump is going to have to decide reaching out to the middle, both within his own party, moderates who are left in the Republican Party and some Democrats who want to work with him, or is he going to deliver more or less what he said he was going to do on Obamacare and immigration and all the rest? And I think that's going to the policy is going to determine just where the politics go in some ways.
We got a wild card here, though, David McEwen. We don't know how Trump is going to work even with his own party because his track record is pretty mixed.
That's right. And there's a tremendous amount of pressure right now on Speaker Ryan and obviously Mitch McConnell. They have spent the time since February setting up basically a parallel legislative program, a program that regardless of who was elected the 45th president of the United States, they could move legislation. Now they have to fall in line. They have to fall in line when you have a Freedom Caucus that isn't one caucus, but it's four different caucuses. And how does Donald Trump herd all of those cats? In addition, this is really a historic victory in many ways. And in a deeply divided nation, a nation when we look at differences in vote totals by race, gender, sexual orientation, educational attainment, it's a deeply divided America. He has to unite that. The irony is that the talent for running for office, divisiveness, division, contrast, which he exhibited so well over the last year and a half, directly the opposite skills for governing, bringing people together, compromise, consensus, that's the challenge for Donald Trump.
Civics 101. Government is done by compromise.
That's right.
And it doesn't necessarily seem, at least in the campaign, to have been that willing to beckon for or to bring forth compromise. Scott, this goes right to the major question, I think, about how he can do that, especially in light of the fact that the Republicans as a party were trying to spread the net. They were trying to bring in Latino voters and women voters. That was really in their audit. And to some extent, Trump has set them back, really, hasn't he?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. It looks like he did about as well as Mitt Romney did among Latino voters, which wasn't great. But I think a lot of people assumed he was going to do much worse, given the rhetoric on Mexican
immigrants. In some areas, he did better than Romney.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he also did better among working-class whites than Romney did. So, you know, there's going to be a whole lot of discussion about the polls because they were so off, with the exception of the LA Times, which for months everyone has been excoriating as a, you know, incorrect outlier. Turns out they were closer to the truth than everybody else.
And David, do you think at this point that the Democratic Party can get their act together? I mean, in terms of unity, we're talking about unity of the country, unity of the Republican Party. But the Democratic Party still has this deep split and fissure, the Bernie people, the millennials who supported him, and those who supported Secretary Clinton.
Right. This is also a dramatically different party than 1968, when we've experienced this before, in 1972 with the Republicans. But the Democrats clearly have to look closely at what happens next for them. Last hour, your guest talked about the generational divide. We see that generational divide not only in California but across the country. That means someone like Kamala Harris, the new U.S. senator from California, has a principal central role, not just within California but nationally. And as we turn our attention to what comes next, this is someone who is going to play a pivotal role along with others in the Democratic Party, many of them women.
But it's a different party. Now you've got blue-collar people like you never had before. Scott, you were going to say?
Well, I was going to say, I think, you know, now that it's clear that the Democrats are not—
blue-collar for the Republicans like you never had before. Yeah, Scott.
Now that it's clear that the Democrats are going to be in the minority still in the House and the Senate, I wouldn't at all be surprised if, for example, Dianne Feinstein decides that she's not going to run for re-election in 2018. So we mentioned Kamala Harris, Gavin Newsom, John Chung, the treasurer, running for governor. If, in fact, Feinstein doesn't run. So there's all this kind of pent-up leadership, folks in their 40s and 50s.
Well, in California. Where is it nationally, though?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, if you look at the governorships, the Republicans had, I think, 30 governorships going into last night. I'm not sure how it's shaken out this morning. But, you know, in a lot of these states, I mean, one of the reasons the Democrats failed to pick up more seats is they generally had weak candidates. I mean, in North Carolina, the former head of the ACLU, that is not a great profile for a candidate in a military state like North Carolina. She was unable to knock off Richard Burr. And so they need to develop a farm team. And not just in California. In California, I think it's there. It's just waiting for those opportunities to move up. But nationally, I think the party really begins to look to people like Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota. I mean, there are a lot of women, frankly, who could step into some of those leadership positions. Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. But they have to take some responsibility, too. This wasn't just Trump pulling the wool over everyone's eyes.
There's also an irony here, too, and that is that Trump ran as an outsider against Washington, and that lack of experience is a selling point. Now we turn to governing, where experience will be highly valued, especially around his team. And so many of the people that you mentioned, they're all in politics. So do Democrats look outside of politics as well? Do they look at outsiders? Someone, you know, even Bernie Sanders, who's been around, is running as an outsider. But do you look at someone like Sheryl Sandberg, someone who can lean in, as you were, or others that can talk about changes that are going on to reset the Democratic Party? That's where the Democrats will find themselves, especially with this generational change and divide. And that cuts across many class lines and many elements of the Democratic base.
All right, we've got many listeners, and I want to get to our callers with Dispatcher. Let me start off with you, Jessica and Davis. Join us, please. You're on.
Thank you, Michael, for taking my call. I wanted to reflect back on something in the first hour when a lot of the comments that you read, I think, from the social media posts that people had sent in were talking about the election having been rigged, that we have the result we have today. And I want to start by saying that I am as heartbroken and terrified as anyone listening is today. But I don't want to see us fall into the same trap that a week ago we would have been rolling our eyes at the same comments when Trump was claiming he wouldn't accept the results if he weren't elected. That, you know, blaming the DNC, blaming the Electoral College, blaming the role of the media, it's too easy. We may need to reform the Electoral College or get rid of it. We may need to do some of those things. But I think we also, to your question of how do we move forward? We all need to reach really deep to understand what half of this country is experiencing, because we clearly really don't understand many of our fellow Americans. And for anyone who knows, you know, has a family member in another state who might have voted the other way, talk to them and try and listen and really hear what they're experiencing, because there's clearly something going on that many of us here in California just don't have a view into.
Well, Jessica, thank you for those comments. I appreciate it. Scott Safer.
Well, and I think, you know, it's sort of a truism. We live in a bubble here in the Bay Area, and you don't have to go far outside of this the nine-county Bay Area to find people who were expressing the very things that Donald Trump was speaking to across the country. I was in Oakdale a few weeks ago, which is near Modesto. And, boy, it was not hard at all to find people who feel disenfranchised. I think what this election is about as much as anything is people, including people who don't feel Donald Trump is qualified to be president, voting for him because they were willing to just upset the apple cart. And they don't agree with him on everything. They don't like some of the things that he said and did. They don't think he's a role model for their kids necessarily. But they are so frustrated with so many aspects of government that they just wanted to, like, whatever, pick your metaphor, throw the cards up in the air and see where they fall.
Almost an anarchic move in the privacy of the voting booth, which brings up the Bradley effect again, David McKeown. Interesting to hear what you have to say about this. A lot of speculation about people not putting up signs for Trump or not openly admitting that they were for Trump or even, in fact, lying and saying they were supporting Hillary Clinton, but then in the privacy of the voting booth, taking a very different tack.
That's exactly right. What you see is this kind of social responsibility, social acceptability bias. People don't want to say that they're supporting Donald Trump. We might see this amongst women for some as an example. And it doesn't mean that he had wide support. It means that, for example, if 30% of women supported Donald Trump and we thought that number was 20%, we're off by 50%. And that's an issue. It means that Latinos, when they go into the voting booth, might have some difficulty voting for a woman for president, but Latinos wouldn't. And these are real things, hard questions that we have to ask. And if we haven't seen these types of things before, or we saw it in California, for example, referencing the Bradley effect in the 1980s, what we really have is facing an electorate that's uncertain, surly, and that was very difficult to capture in the models where we've been completely
off. Well, it
makes
it pretty hard if you're a pollster, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and also, let's not forget, and you may have talked about this in the first hour, Michael, but the headwinds, the historical headwinds that Hillary Clinton faced. I mean, there's only been one time since World War II, since a party won three consecutive presidential elections. That was essentially Ronald Reagan's third term with George H.W. Bush. It doesn't happen for a reason. People get tired of the same party.
There's a kind of dialectic here. I mean, you know,
it's a pendulum.
It's a pendulum, exactly. Scrap that academic word. No, but I mean, you go from the Bush administration, which is conservative, to a liberal administration, Obama, you go back to conservatism, and it vacillates.
I always feel that voters, in their wisdom, they want what they don't have, you know, and I feel that they, this time around, they felt that they didn't have someone who was listening to their concerns, was too focused on money in politics and special interests and, you know, tax breaks for the wealthy. Now, Donald Trump is an ironic and imperfect messenger or vessel for that frustration. But nonetheless, he was the best choice a lot of those folks felt.
Also an ironic choice when you think about the silver spoon he was born with and the kind of gilded life he's had in terms of the working class and people who are seeing themselves as essentially blue collar identifying with. But let me bring some more callers in here. And Yash, you're next up. Good morning.
Good morning. So I'm a recent graduate from UC Davis, and one of the big things I'm really curious about is Obamacare. Throughout the campaign, Trump was saying that, you know, he was going to completely repeal Obamacare. And now that he has control over the legislative body, maybe even the judicial body in the future, I'm really curious where this is going to go. Yeah. Even a lot of my conservative friends have said, you know, their families are very happy about how they're going to be covering their children until the age of 26. But for the most part, everyone's been like very unhappy about it. So I'm very curious.
You've located, it seems to me, the central issue with Obamacare. A lot of people have, are pleased with what it offers them, especially where their children are concerned. But David McKeown, how do you think this is going to ride out?
Well,
Trump did promise to get rid of it completely.
Yeah, certainly Obamacare probably doesn't last 1 year with the votes that they have in both the Senate and the House. Republicans are going to push this early and often. What Republicans haven't had to do, though, is actually propose an alternative for what that looks like. And that's the rub. And the big question here is, can Donald Trump unite the country and provide some alternatives moving forward? And his alternative for Obamacare is going to be front and center in terms of, a real test for him early and often here.
Yeah, I mean, California is one of the states where obviously we've embraced Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and especially the expansion of Medi-Cal, the low-income health care plan. And that is where the federal purse strings come in. And so that is what, you know, certainly the House will be looking at. But, you know, as David said, How many times did the House vote on repealing Obamacare? 40-something times?
Yeah, more than 40
times. Because they knew they didn't have to live with the consequences of throwing 18 million people off of health insurance. People are now have gotten used to some of these benefits. Their kids on their plan until they're 26. You can't get tossed off your health insurance for having a pre-existing condition or getting sick. You know, if you suddenly pull the rug out from all that, you know, you've got a problem. And I think Donald Trump knows that. He was for Obamacare before he was against it, if you recall. He said some things that were conciliatory. He said, we're going to keep the mandate. Well, that is Obamacare, is the mandate.
Think about the irony of that. Mitt Romney was responsible for being the architect of Obamacare,
and
he had to oppose it when he ran.
And this might be the time Republicans remember that it was a Republican idea.
Or that, you know, what's somebody like John Kasich do in Ohio? Does he accept federal money in a different guise? What does this look like? I mean, this is the politics of this. As you mentioned, the politics and policy get very interesting very quickly, shortly after Donald Trump is inaugurated.
Let me go to another caller. This is a Muslim American who's calling us from Danville. Molson, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am recently become citizen about 2 years back, and this is my first election. And looking at what's happening with the anti-Islamophobic rhetoric coming out from President-elect Donald Trump, I'm just wishing that the laws of the country will continue to be in place and keep us safe. And today morning, when my daughter wake up, she was basically in a shock state, and I had to give up assurances that life will be fine since this is a country of rule and law. So my question would be, is that do we have any example previously in this country as this has happened, and how can we, like the Muslims and Americans living in this country, be assured that their life will be as good as it is now today and not going to be any worse tomorrow and when he becomes a president?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that question, Molson, and I thank you for it. It is a concern of many Muslim Americans. And in fact, we have Zahra Bilow on the line, an executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And CARE is the largest American Muslim civil liberties group. Zahra Bilow, welcome to the program. Glad to have you.
Thank you for having me.
What do you say to a caller like Molson, who expresses deep concern and daughters crying and so forth, to the kind of fears and serious concerns that were expressed by him?
It's been 18 months of nonstop hate, vitriol, and an actual manifestation of violence against the Muslim community. Molson is one of many people we're hearing from who are saying their kids are afraid, they don't know what to do, and they don't know what will come next. And so for those people, we're saying we're recommitting our resources and our intentions to protecting the civil rights of American Muslims, but also all Americans. It's important to keep in mind that our president-elect has targeted many different communities. And so to our friends and allies, we say today is a day to stand together and to continue to work together. It's going to be lawsuits. It's going to be Know Your Rights presentations. It's going to be lobbying and advocacy. We have our work cut out for us, but we're not going anywhere.
What do you think about the people who voted for Donald Trump? Particularly in light of some of the toxic things he said about Muslims and wanting to essentially stand in the way of really what I think we could broadly characterize as freedom of Muslim Americans.
Right. You know, I understand that no voting group and no support group for any candidate is a monolith. Unfortunately, both parties failed to put forward a visionary and uniting candidate. And so I don't think that people that voted for Donald Trump are racist necessarily, but I do think they've elected a racist, and they have put us in a difficult position.
Are you hopeful to a greater extent after hearing Trump's speech? He said Americans are made up of all religions and really need to come together.
I am approaching him with an open mind, as Hillary Clinton referenced in her concession speech. I think that there is, of course, a possibility that the American people can move him away from the hate and vitriol that really signified his campaigning. But I'm also pragmatic. He has made a lot of really frightening and problematic promises. And so we have our work. We have our work to do, and we're not going to take for granted that he said some nice words today after 18 months of so many terrible ones.
I'm sorry, but I need to ask you, what does your work represent when you talk about the work to do?
So at CARE, we provide direct legal representation. We mobilize Muslim voters and others to hold their elected officials accountable, to continue to stay engaged November 9th and onward. We do community education so that people know what their rights are, and we're working with allies and friends. Just in a little while, one of my colleagues will be at a press conference with immigrant rights advocates to say, many communities are concerned, and we're stronger when we stand together.
Zahra Ballou is Executive Director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. That's the CARE group in the San Francisco Bay Area, the largest American Muslim civil liberties group. And thank you so much for joining us this morning on Forum.
Thank you for having me.
There's a comment from Chris who says, I think we have to ask the question how this election will impact Latino families with members who have different immigration status. We woke up today in fear for our relatives and whether or not we would be targeted or our family members deported. There's always been fear in immigrant communities, but it is now compounded with a genuine threat and a deep sadness. Here we're hearing from communities that are really frightened, and understandably so, given the rhetoric.
With very good reason. And I think this is where members of the Republican Party, like Jeff Flake from Arizona, the senator, and John McCain from Arizona, people like Lindsey Graham, Rob Portman in Ohio, who understand that the rhetoric in that campaign was incendiary and unhelpful and hurtful and all the rest. You know, I'm kind of a believer of unintended and unanticipated consequences in politics. And I remember Ronald Reagan getting elected and sweeping out a lot of Democrats who'd been in the Senate for a long time in 1980. And while there were certainly issues with Ronald Reagan's presidency, including, you know, the fact that he ignored AIDS for almost his entire time in office, you know, he also appointed Supreme Court justices who were excoriated by the left and then ended up upholding pro-choice laws and, you know, striking down bans on same-sex marriage. So you can't really tell sometimes.
But, you know, I was thinking you're absolutely right about unintended consequences, especially when I talked to Jeffrey Toobin recently about Supreme Court justices, and he said there's a myth to some extent that a Supreme Court justice may go through a change because of Earl Warren going through the rather prodigious changes when he took over. But I thought you were going to say something about Reagan in respect to there will be a bloodbath if there has to be a bloodbath. Remember that rhetoric about Berkeley protests?
Oh, in 64, we ran for 66.
Exactly, and somehow that lasted and that couldn't be turned around. It was always there in the minds of particularly protesters.
And I think the concerning thing, too, is that, you know, Donald Trump has never in this campaign exhibited particular interest or aptitude for focusing on complicated problems for any length of time. And so who is going to be doing that in this administration aside from his cabinet? Is he going to basically designate a lot of the day-to-day kinds of governing responsibilities to Mike Pence, the vice president, which sends shudders down the spines of some, but also he is a comfortable link to the Senate and to the House for others. So, you know, it really remains to be seen. But I do think that, you know, I mean, Hillary Clinton said you have to keep an open mind. What choice do you have, I guess?
Well, what do you think, David McEwen? Is Pence going to be another Cheney, or is he lined up to be a possible Cheney here?
Mike Pence is certainly lined up to continue the culture war kind of argument. The difficulty is what happens beyond that, because that culture war is only going to get you so far in terms of governing. Something to pay attention to, I think, and watch.
All right. Well, we'll also pay attention to what our listeners have to say. Here's Robert who says, can we finally acknowledge Democrats business as usual is no longer viable? They must stop relying on the richest Americans placing so much importance on their donors' concerns and instead conduct massive outreach to register and bring into the civic fold the millions of Americans who do not even bother to vote. When they do that, they'll win elections by landslides. We'll continue hearing your comments and hearing from you, our listeners, and talking with David McEwen of Sonoma State and Scott Schaefer of KQED. Feel free to join the program. You can do it by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about last night's election, the historic election of Donald Trump as the 45th president of the United States. David McEwen in studio with us, professor of in the Department of Political Science at Sonoma State, and Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. A lot of responses coming in, as you could certainly imagine, and we do welcome your involvement in the program and do want to hear from you. Our toll-free number, again, is 866-733-6786, or you can email your thoughts and questions to us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Here's a listener who writes, I'm so distraught today, as is my husband. I don't feel connected to the United States at all and do think a revolution against Trumpism and the Republican Party is necessary. By the way, there was, I think, the website about migration to Canada busted. There were too many people who went on it.
Nova Scotia was popular.
Melissa writes, I'm taking last night as a loss and a direct hit to feminism. She was more qualified than any man before her, yet people aren't ready for a female hero. What do you think, Scott, in terms of we talked about it in the last hour to some extent with Joan Walsh, but has to be brought into the picture.
It does. You know, I think there were a lot of people who felt that way in 2008 when Barack Obama sort of cut the line. And as a freshman senator and defeated Hillary Clinton, she in many ways was more qualified, or not experienced, I think is a better word. And, you know, I think back to Massachusetts, Martha Coakley, who was the attorney general in Massachusetts, lost to Scott Brown when John Kerry left that job, and also then ran for governor and lost in a state that's so deep blue. So there is no question that women do have challenges and prejudices that men do not have. But Hillary Clinton was also a flawed candidate. She was dogged from the beginning to the end about this email server, never figured out a way to put that away.
Well,
it kept coming back.
Now,
and the foundation. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I was sort of kidding with people that, that I was already exhausted from the Clinton administration, even though she hadn't won yet, just because there does, you know, and I think that there was a fatigue, a Clinton fatigue that had set in for all those reasons. And I think that was some of what fueled Bernie Sanders' popularity. You know, I think a lot of folks just kind of felt like, let's, as Barack Obama said, let's turn the page.
Well, she was, I don't want to speak about her in the past tense because I think she'll still be in public life, but what a fighter. I mean, to go up against Obama and then to go up against Sanders and then to go up against Trump.
Well, on the composure she showed this morning when she came out and spoke and gave, a fairly moving speech and extremely gracious and thoughtful, and just to be able to withstand that. I mean, it's. I mean, she may have, you know, had a horrible, horrible night last night and this morning, and maybe after she spoke this morning, she broke down. But you know, just the fact that she could hold it together the way she did is extraordinary.
David, Scott was also mentioning. Excuse me, David. I hear what you have to say on this, but Scott was also mentioning red turning blue and blue turning red and everything. I mean, we have seen, especially in the Rust Belt, a real turnover here. I mean, Wisconsin, Michigan, they were pretty much blue states. It was a foregone conclusion they were going to go for Hillary Clinton. At least, certainly, one could say that about Wisconsin, where she didn't even appear.
That's right. And if you look at Pennsylvania, it's gone the last six presidential elections, it's gone blue. And what you saw last night also was a series of underperformances by Secretary Clinton. And as those series of underperformances added up over time, particularly in the Rust Belt on issues around trade, immigration, some of that divisive rhetoric around crooked Hillary, the knocks that she would take, not only perhaps as a flawed candidate, but 30 years of that, that all built up. And we saw evidence of that last night in that underperformance.
Well, we haven't talked much about the FBI, but you have to figure in the Comey handling of the emails and it resurfacing again. In some ways, you know, it was like she was exonerated, but it put it all back out there again.
She was having more momentum at the time that came out.
The first one when he sent that letter to the Republican leadership in Congress. I mean, it was a precipitous drop, and I mean the initial indications were that it was going to cost them the Senate, and it just kept, I think, going down, and then resurfacing again on Sunday. I think it fueled that fatigue. And, you know, Trump played it very well. He said, look, we're going to have investigations into the, you know, as far as we can see if she's elected now.
He said to appoint a special prosecutor. Now, is he going to have to follow through on that? I mean, this special prosecutor.
I think we're going to see amnesia setting in pretty quickly.
Yeah,
a number of things that he promised, because they're great campaign rhetoric, but they don't work so well when you're governing.
Right. He could theoretically pardon her and appear both magnanimous and at the same time revisit the issue of what to do.
Well, there's nothing to pardon her from.
Right. But he could do that from the rhetoric is what he could do. And then he could move on with the collective amnesia to begin talking about what he wants to do as president.
I mean, you don't want to be a sore
winner. Even if there was something to move forward, he could do what Nixon did. I mean, what Gerald Ford did with Nixon and partner as well.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would think the last thing the Republicans want to do is be sore winners and, you know, continue to divide the country further. Toward what end? I mean, they won. So
I think that's part of the key ingredient here for this election and it being a teachable moment. You win with grace and class and you lose with grace and class. And that's what we've seen so far this morning. But the challenge moving forward is uniting the country and teaching our young people and teaching those that feel left out in this kind of collective group therapy session how we move forward as a country.
Well, let me bring up the fact that Berkeleyside reports that 1,500 Berkeley High students walked out this morning in protest. That's here, of course, in the Bay Area. But we're also getting I almost say being flooded with criticism of the Democrats and of the media, many of them, of course, from Democrats. Here's Katie, for example, who tweets, find me any positive media coverage Hillary got. Even when he lied throughout, he got positive media. Why? Ratings. Gary writes, the Democrats used to help the American worker, but now help the banks and Wall Street disproportionately. If the Dems actually stood up for principles and policies they traditionally have in the past, things would be much different this morning and going forward. And let me go forward to some more of your calls. Let's bring Damien in. Damien, you're on.
Hi. Great conversation. And just not to be a downer, but there's a lot of anger in the country. And all this conciliatory talk, I'm sorry, is not going to go very far. There's a lot of angry people on the Democratic side. And I don't think it's fair to have the Democrats and those people who lost all of a sudden bow down to the Republicans who have been opposing Democratic endeavors for the last 8 years. But just to my point, the reason I called was because one of the differences between the RNC and the DNC was the RNC let the voters vote. And they didn't like Trump any more than anyone else did, but they let the voters speak. And the DNC, whether you guys dismiss it or not, they colluded. And they did not give Bernie the opportunity or the flexibility that they gave Clinton. It was almost like he was an inconvenience. And I think that really spoke to why she lost. Because my wife, who is a Muslim and completely, you know, will be affected by Trump, as he's an immigrant as well, hated Clinton. So I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can't underestimate the impact of WikiLeaks, you know, on this election. Yeah. That constant drip, 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 the DNC emails, the internal emails that went back and forth. In some ways, it was a lot less newsy than we thought it might have been. But, you know, the information about the speeches to Goldman Sachs and this, what she was saying on the inside versus what she was saying on the outside. And I do think it fueled cynicism. I mean, in a lot of ways, it confirmed what people like Damien or his wife felt about Hillary Clinton. But I think it also just really did undermine enthusiasm for her. And a lot of what Donald Trump was doing in the last couple of weeks is really pushing down turnout, you know, trying to tamp down enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton.
The Clinton campaign didn't handle this very well. I mean, they haven't handled this very well for a year, year and a half.
They were never really able to answer it.
They never were able to go back at it. They took often, they let Donald be Donald during the debates, and there were just tactical error after tactical error combined with that underperformance created a whole host of problems for a perfect storm where the demographics were on their side and they couldn't turn it around.
I got to ask you both, and in many people's minds, whenever you talk about third-party candidates, it's a minor question, everything. But the pollsters got it wrong there, too. They thought Gary Johnson was running at about 5, 6, even 7%. Maybe he was hurt by Aleppo, who, or whatever. But then, you know, you had Jill Stein running at 3%. They didn't do nearly what the pollsters thought they would do.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot, where as crunch time comes and you have to cast your ballot, people don't want to, quote unquote, throw away their vote. And this was a very consequential election. We did see there were some websites where you could trade votes if you were in California, trade your vote for Jill Stein with somebody, you know, in Florida. But, you know, by and large, I think people want to vote for – they want a vote for a candidate who has a chance to win. And obviously the third-party candidates in the system that we have just didn't have it, didn't have that. Evan McMullen in Utah, who many thought for a while might actually
win. They thought
he was going
to win, yeah.
He came in, I think, third place.
Well, here's Joseph who writes, might the Trump victory allow states to go – speaking about Utah, their own way, just as the Constitution intended? Might this be a proper opportunity for liberals? In other words, focus on state and local solutions rather than federal. In a page from the Reagan playbook, Trump could block grant to the states to catalyze infrastructure rebuilding and Medicaid reform.
Well, you know, if you look at what California did or appears to be doing, and there's still, we have to say, there's like 3 million votes or so to count still. We legalized pot. We tightened restrictions on guns and ammunition. We said yes to making it easier for nonviolent felons to get out of prison. We passed a huge school bond. We increased the cigarette tax.
Did you see the article in Politico titled California Lurching Left? I mean, it's true.
Yeah, no.
It's still the great exception.
Yeah, it is.
That's what we see.
It is.
Yeah. It is absolutely the great exception.
And Jerry Brown had a great night last night.
Gavin
Newsom it appears that he did.
Well,
it's not over yet.
Except for that farmer down in Stockton.
Well, but he's right now that measure's losing. But, you know, we'll see. There's still a lot of votes to count.
And a lot of callers to go to. Let me go next to Greg. Greg, you're on.
Good morning. I'm listening to you guys, and it sounds like you guys are talking about a sports team. And I own several homes in Ohio and Tennessee, and, you know, I was afraid to put up a sign for Hillary because of my neighbors all have, you know, vote for Trump. And, you know, they don't care that Hillary's a woman. They don't care about what Trump's saying. All they care about is putting food on the table, and it's getting really difficult to do that there. And, you know, that's what this election was about. And I think, you know, it's just really, you know, like California living in a bubble and these other larger cities, you know, these places haven't recovered from the recession. You know, I'm flying all the way out here just to drive for Uber and look for a better job because the opportunities there are just so stagnant. And, you know, it's so funny that the Democratic Party just was so disconnected from the working class that they couldn't even see that just by driving through a few neighborhoods. You know, my neighbors, they will work hard. There isn't the opportunity. And, you know, we don't have politicians that are able to be honest with the public and say, those jobs are gone. We need to retool. We need to do this. We need to do that for the future of this country. And, you know, there's no job that Trump can bring back. So he just basically, you know, created this big thought of, you know, nothingness. And we're going to have in 4 years even more angry people and more technology is going to come down. There's going to be more professionals that are out of work. And, you know, nobody's going to be able to move forward because they can't be honest with us.
Greg, I've got to recommend a book to you and to listeners that we featured here in Forum called Hillbilly Elegy, since you have a home in Ohio, all about how working class people have felt betrayed and just pretty much in line with what you've expressed here. And I thank you for expressing it. I just did want to say something about the sports analogy, though. We get this a lot. You know, you talk about political elections and you talk about races and so forth. And, you know, this is like a big Super Bowl, and we even got, you know, Bon Jovi and Springsteen and all the rest coming to the rescue or trying to come to the rescue of Hillary Clinton. It's unavoidable, and it's difficult because you want to talk more about policy, but look at how much really did policy ultimately play in this?
Well, you know, we went through how long was this campaign? It felt like forever, at least a year and a half, and climate change didn't come up once the debates.
When Trump said he'd rip up the climate change,
exactly.
The Paris Agreement.
I mean, so it's, you know, unfortunately in politics, complicated, thoughtful, measured responses to complicated, nuanced problems don't sell that well. It's sad, but it's true. You know, it's like Mario Cuomo said, you campaign in prose and you govern in
poetry
and campaign.
The reverse, yeah.
It's the reverse. And you govern in prose, you know, and I wouldn't say what Donald Trump has been saying was poetry, but the point is, you know, it's slogans. It's things that sound good and sweet to the ears of voters. And then there's the reality of governing.
And Keith writes, I can't imagine how ignorant the mainstream is of reality. The middle of the country is in pain, mm-hmm. and the government can't give a damn. We are getting payback for ignoring the populace. Let's go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Oakland. Elizabeth, we welcome you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I had a couple of questions and also a comment. One of the first ones is, one of your other guests at the beginning of the show mentioned 7 million Democrats who didn't vote for various reasons. But I also want to know how many independents and also how many Democrats did not turn out for the vote to give us a better idea of the popular vote that could have been had. Second of all, I want to know if this is the largest number of independent voters ever seen in the history of the country. And my comment is, I grew up in the South. I grew up in Tennessee. I left specifically because of the racism that I saw there. I voted third party absentee vote in New York City, where I used to live, because they haven't registered in California yet, because I knew that it was not a swing state. That is the only reason that I voted third party. But I do, a lot of my family members are still living in the South, and they are not racist. They are economically depressed, and they have a lot of economic problems. They don't like the racist talk that's going on, but there's also a political historian, Tony Jett, who mentioned that we're living in a day and age now where things have to be blown up. There's not this kind of peaceful transition to change. We are living in a society now where things have to be completely blown up and destroyed in order for change to happen. And I think people have finally gotten to that point.
All right, right. Let me break in here, because you raised a question initially, and I want to see if anybody can provide those figures. I don't know if we have them handy. Numbers who turned out or didn't turn out, and also independents who turned out. Can we shed some light on that?
I can't speak to the national numbers. Here in California, of course, the no party preference category of voters is the largest, fastest growing part of the electorate. It's up to about 25% now. It's almost going to eclipse Republicans. But, you know, those voters also tend to skew younger, and younger voters tend to vote less than older voters do. So I don't know. I haven't looked at the numbers. we were getting sort of ballot updates from Paul Mitchell at Political Data, Inc. I don't know, David, you may have more.
I haven't seen the latest updates on this, but what we have seen happen is voters lurching to the middle, lurching to this no-party preference, not only in California, but also nationally, concerned about their economic conditions and much less tied to party while the politicians have moved out. So if you see your caller talks about this, we have leaders that are out on the polls. We have voters that are in the middle. So actually, they're blowing things up. I think an aspect of this is social media, the rise of social media, the rise of alt-right, all key ingredients of this last year and a half. And now the difficulty is, how do we move forward given those set of circumstances? Very challenging.
Well, I want to bring Lonnie Chen into this. I think we have a good line now for you, Lonnie. I hope so. Or you have a good line for us. He's a research fellow at Hoover. Speak to me and let me hear.
No, I'm here. I am.
Oh, okay. Now you're coming through loud and clear. I'm glad. I should also mention that Lonnie Chen is a former policy director for the Mitt Romney 2012 presidential campaign. And one of the things I suppose that alienated Donald Trump from many of the Romney supporters, including Romney himself, was Trump talking earlier again about Romney being a loser and having blown it and everything. But looking back from your perch and from the perspective of the past, what did Trump do that Romney could have done or didn't do? Or what did Romney do that he should have done that Trump did?
Yeah, well, I think that's going to be the question that folks will be discussing for some time. I mean, obviously, I think he was able to speak to a group of voters who I was always a little skeptical existed, but clearly do, which is, you know, folks who have felt really left behind by the economic changes that we've seen over these many last years, probably since the Great Recession of 2008, 2009. And that group of people felt legitimately that government was not speaking to them. And I think the one thing that Donald Trump was able to do very well was to give voice to that in a way that I think previous Republican nominees just haven't been able to. And I think we have to acknowledge his success at appealing to that demographic, and that really propelled him to the victory he had last night. His success across the Rust Belt was indicative of that.
The thing that's always sort of been a question in my mind, though, is there was a lot of questioning about Mitt Romney's business tactics and his being a capitalist, and a lot of the criticism, particularly from the, I suppose, folks that would have been allied with Bernie Sanders, and a lot of criticism of Hillary Clinton for giving speeches to Goldman Sachs and the like. Why do you suppose Trump got a pass on that? Because to some of his business practices, I mean, they were brought up as stiffing people and all the rest of it, but not like the ferocity that you saw with Romney and Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think there's two issues at play here. One is the way that that Donald Trump handled those issues. You know, he was always very proud and outspoken about his business success. And I think to a certain degree, there are some who admired that he was willing to not just defend his record in business, but to speak positively about it in a way that conveyed to people that he had great success in business. I think that's one thing. I think the second thing, and this has been written about, I think, and talked about by some liberal commentators, is this idea of crying wolf. That, you know, in 2012, there was such an effort to demonize Mitt Romney, who really had conducted himself honorably in both the business and political spheres. There was such an effort to make him into just this caricature of a very, very sort of evil person, that when the time came to really assess Mr. Trump's business record, you know, folks out there maybe weren't as willing to buy it. And I think that that contrast is really important. The notion of crying wolf 4 years ago really did compromise their ability to make the case this time around.
But Tony Schwartz, who wrote The Art of the Deal, came out with a whole expose of how he had taken the tack of a fiction writer more than a journalist in terms of Trump's triumphs and all the rest of it. Didn't seem to stick, though. It was simply Velcro for the most part.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's hard. You know, there's a little bit of coastal bias here, too. You know, being in major media markets on the West Coast and the East Coast, sometimes it can be difficult to assess the success or lack thereof of certain political tactics. And I think this time in particular, you know, a lot of analysts just missed a completely different set of political trends that were affecting broad majorities of people in the middle of the country versus on the coasts.
Lonnie, what's your hope for a Trump term?
Well, you know, look, I think at least on paper, a lot of what Trump is talking about from a policy perspective, certainly in the economic space, whether it's on tax policy or, for example, on health care, would be the sort of apex of conservative policy priorities, at least stated policy priorities for the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. Certainly much of the Obama agenda is under threat now. And so, you know, obviously speaking from the perspective of a market-oriented analyst, my hope is that he moves through with some of these things he's talked about, certainly on healthcare reform, you know, orienting it more toward consumers and markets as opposed to toward government control would be a huge thing. So, I am of the school of thought that while we've all had our disagreements with him, he's now the president. And, you know, I think it's important that we look ahead rather than behind.
Lonnie Chen, again, is research fellow at the Hoover Institution and was policy director for Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. Thank you so much for joining us, Lonnie.
Thank you.
Let me go to more of your calls, and let's go next to to Sarah, who's joining us from Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Most Democrats that I'm encountering today are all drowning in the slough of despond, but we do have to move forward, and I'm wondering if you and your guests have any advice about how we stem the tide and activate our democratic principles and values in these coming years. How do we do that?
Central question requiring great wisdom and foresight. And have some thoughts from our guests. Go ahead.
You know, I think this election has physically and emotionally exhausted so many people, and people were just very emotionally invested, even though many Americans dislike both candidates. And I think the first order of business is kind of take care of yourself and kind of get away from politics for a little bit. You know, don't think about 2020 or 2018 today or tomorrow or this weekend. You know, spend some time with your family. Go for a walk. Go to the beach. It's just been so nasty and personal and poisonous. I think the first step for all of us is to take a deep breath and step back and then hope that Donald Trump and his administration find the better angels of their nature and, you know, try to bring the country together. And, you know, I think Democrats, well, I can't speak for the party, whether they will reach back if that hand is extended, we'll have to see. I mean, there's going to be a lot of very sore feelings for a long time to come, especially, I think, when you fold in what happened with the FBI in the final weeks of the campaign.
Let me go to a question and go to you on this, Scott, too, because George says, I'm a gay married man in the North Bay. I'm waking up today truly concerned that my marriage may be in jeopardy, and I want to know if you think marriage equality could indeed be rolled back in a Trump presidency.
You know, I really don't. I think that's a settled question. And Donald Trump, whatever you may think of him, that is not an issue. I mean, Donald Trump, to the consternation of a lot of conservatives, came out in opposition to the so-called bathroom law in North Carolina when it passed. That is not the social issues.
He was also a liberal Democrat and a Hillary Clinton supporter. He had a whole avatar before the president.
And I think vice president, though, who did talk about
exactly.
this issue.
And I think that's the question.
Let's not forget Mike Pence.
But I think that, you know, one of the things that concerned conservatives like Ted Cruz is that Donald Trump really isn't conservative. And we'll see, who's in charge when it comes to picking judges. I mean, Trump did release a list of 20 judges, conservative judges that he said he would choose. But I just don't see the country going backwards on that. I could be wrong. I mean, there's still a lot of other issues besides LGBT marriage, transgender rights and workplace discrimination and family law.
But all those 20 judges that he put into play here, so to speak, we're all pro-life judges, and that's where Mike Pence is. We may go backward on Roe v. Wade.
It's possible.
I don't know if we're going to go backward on gay marriage, but that's possible too. Let me go, if I could, back to you, Doug McKeown. There's a question from a listener named Doug, and a lot of listeners have David McKeown, excuse me. A lot of listeners have been asking about voter suppression, and Doug writes, how much of a factor was voter suppression in this election? The states that had been under federal oversight for historic discrimination were free this year to suppress those voters. Isn't that likely reason that Clinton did not receive as many black votes as were expected?
Yeah, I mean, look squarely at North Carolina, right, where the Clinton campaign had to challenge extra hours staying open in those areas. And if you have one early voting area for 661,000 African Americans, that's suppressing the vote. We saw that in North Carolina. It certainly is an effect in Florida. And these are all states that Donald Trump did very well in and will continue to do. That's something to monitor, I think, moving forward. But after we take that long walk that Scott talked about.
No, I think that is one of the most cynical policies to try to restrict it, to claim hide behind voter fraud, which there's so little evidence of.
You're more likely to be struck by lightning than experience voter fraud.
And you know, minorities see that as, you know, trying to disenfranchise them, and it's extremely cynical. And that would be one place, I think, that a President Trump could, you know, find some conciliation, is to let's make it easier for everyone to vote. I mean, that's what we're supposed to be about, democracy.
Imagine if he changed his rhetoric on immigration, reached out to Hispanics, overwhelmingly Roman Catholic, overwhelmingly small business orientation, suspicious of government. He could craft a new coalition. Now, that would challenge Democrats in a big, big way.
And here's Gail. Gail, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi. My concern, speaking briefly, I'm a native, and my concern is that the earth is in real danger, and President Trump doesn't seem to be concerned about that. And we only have really 5 years to make a radical decision. So that's my major concern with this presidency.
Understood. Like I said before, this as a candidate, Trump said he would rip up the Paris Agreement, among other things, and that global warming doesn't exist. And in fact, at one point said it was a myth propagated by the Chinese. Here's a tweet from Adnan, who says concession speeches have absolutely zero to do with election rules. Case in point, Al Gore. It's very much still on.
It's certainly still on, but also a time, I think, to take a pause and heal. It's been a very divisive year and a half, and it's uncertain what's going to happen when Congress comes back in the session on Monday. It's uncertain what happens moving forward, and this is a time really to kind of pause and heal before we do that. Then it will be back on.
Well, we'll leave it there. You get last word, David, and thank you, David McEwen, Professor of Department of Political Science at Sonoma State. And thank you, Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. We also spoke with Lonnie Chen from the Hoover Institution and Zara Billow from the Council on American Islamic Relations. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour's repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion online by simply going to kqed.org/forum. Tomorrow we will look at the state and local results, and that includes all the ballot measures. We'll spend the hour the way we had intended originally, but we're cut in by President Obama's speech. Thank you for being a part of the program, and let me tell you who's behind the scenes here. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Senior editor Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.